This is Law and Disorder.
This week on Law and Disorder, we'll talk to lead attorney Barbara Olshansky from the Center for Constitutional Rights about the Pentagon's plan to transfer about half of the Guantanamo detainees.
The Center for Constitutional Rights spent the last week trying to stop these transfers to places like Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and other countries where torture is routine.
We'll also delve deeper into the subject of rendition with the case of U.S. citizen Ahmed Omar Abu Ali, the American college student who went abroad to study in Saudi Arabia and didn't come back.
As soon as he was put into a Saudi jail, many believe at the behest of the United States, and a lawsuit was filed that there was going to be discovery on why he was there, the United States brought him back to the United States.
Brad Adams from Human Rights Watch will join us to talk about two U.S. citizens who disappeared into the jails of Pakistan. They're missing to this day.
Once again, disappeared from America.
All that and more on this week's Law and Disorder.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Dalia Hashad, Arab Muslim South Asian advocate for the ACLU.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. Our fourth host, Michael Stephen Smith, is out of town.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th. At a certain point, it'll be irreversible.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. We'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We'll be lawyers you'll like.
Two years ago, Rachel Corrie, a young woman protesting Palestinian house demolitions, was murdered when she was run over by a Caterpillar bulldozer.
She was a volunteer with International Solidarity Movement, and at the time of her death, she was trying to stop a bulldozer from razing the home of a Palestinian doctor and his family.
House demolitions, unfortunately, are all too common in Israel and in the West Bank as well as Gaza.
That's right, Michael. As you know, I spent some time there working on the issue of house demolitions. They are in clear sight, they are waving their arms, they are shouting through the bullhorn, and they are doing everything to catch the attention of the person. And so that's why it was so unbelievable to find that the Israeli military had gotten so bold that they started attacking actually American activists.
Ladaya, they do this in part because they claim that a member of the family who lives in that house is a terrorist or a bomber or something?
They do it for a couple reasons. One of the reasons that they do it is collective punishment. So, for example, one person will be arrested. So it'll be like someone was arrested here in the United States, and they'll go to the house of their grandmother. They'll go to the house of their brother. They'll go to the house of their sister, and they'll raise that home to the ground and render that family homeless. The second reason that they've been doing it is because they use a legal loophole in the law to say you don't have permission to build on your land. Basically, any Palestinian has to get permission to build on the West Bank or Gaza a home, a permit, and they never give these permits to Palestinians. So you have no choice. You're either going to be homeless or you build a house, quote unquote, illegally. You just build and you hope they won't come and raise it. And they come and they raise the home on the land they want most to occupy. So what you find is you find these circles around Jerusalem and around the edges of the West Bank and Gaza that encroach further and further on the inside where they're raising homes in the hope that they can capture that land.
You know, particularly I think the collective punishment is considered a war crime and it's outlawed by Geneva. And one of the things about what Rachel was doing is she was protesting a war crime. She was trying to stop a war crime from being committed.
This has been an ongoing battle. And when they come to demolish a home, when there are peace activists there, it is often something that's been going on for weeks, kind of confrontation that's been going on for weeks, and the peace activists will actually live in the house with the Palestinian family, and so that if they hear the bulldozers coming in the middle of the night, as they often do, they'll get up and they'll stand outside the home. This happened, I think, around sunset, a little bit before. I'm pretty sure they must have known that she was there. I can't imagine. There were other people in the house. She's wearing that reflective jacket. And not only did they run her over, but he backed up and ran her over twice with the blade down. And there are pictures immediately after she's been run over, and her face is mangled. Her chest was crushed. She didn't have a hope of survival. It's truly sad that she died in this way, but she's actually not the only case. Shortly after her death, there was another gentleman who was shot in the face while he had his hands up. I believe he was in the West Bank, and the whole city was on lockdown for several weeks. They call it curfew. No one could go out of their house for weeks, but of course people run out of food, they run out of medicine, they run out of water, they need to leave. And he was one of those people who was out, and he had his hands up, and he was shot directly in the face, shattering his jaw, and he survived, but he's had severe disfigurement. But this incursion into peace activists from around the world is very bold, and I think the silence of the U.S. government speaks volumes about what they're willing to let the State of Israel do to Palestinians without notice.
Our guest today on the program to discuss the Rachel Corrie murder, as well as a lawsuit that was recently filed by the Center for Constitutional Rights, is Maria LaHood, a lawyer at the center. She will discuss the lawsuit that the center has recently filed against Caterpillar, the company that has been making the bulldozers that Israel has used in house demolitions.
Welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you.
Maria, a few days ago you filed an important case on behalf of the Corrie family against Caterpillar Bulldozer Company.
Well, the Corries have sued Caterpillar for the death of Rachel Corrie because Caterpillar was complicit in the human rights violations going on in Gaza where Rachel was killed. They've been selling bulldozers to the Israeli Defense Forces since they've had notice that those bulldozers have been used to demolish homes unlawfully under international law and also have been killing people.
A lot of people say, well, you know what? They're not making the bulldozer for the express purpose of bulldozing homes or killing individuals. They're making the bulldozers because that's their product. What do you have to say about that?
Under the law, they don't have to intend that the bulldozers be used to kill people in order to be liable for damages and be responsible for those deaths. They just have to know that they were going to be used or would likely be used for that purpose, which they did have notice of.
How did they have notice of that?
Well, they had notice because in the international community, it was well known that in the occupied territories, Israel was demolishing homes. At least it was well known since around 1989. In about 1999, human rights organizations around the world were discussing it and issuing reports about it. Rafah, the small area along the Gaza Strip where Rachel was killed, it's maybe 2.5 miles long, a piece of land. In the past 4 years, I think maybe 2,000 homes have been demolished
Wow,
in just
really?
That small area. And, you know, Caterpillar also knew, even if for some reason, you know, they were blind to what the world knew, people were writing them letters as early as 2001 saying, Caterpillar, this is what's happening there.
Is it a crime to do what Caterpillar's doing?
House demolitions are a crime under various provisions of international law. It's first of all being used in Palestine as a form of collective punishment to punish people possibly for crimes their families or relatives have committed, for just being located in areas where Israel wants to take land, either for zone areas or recently to build the wall, sometimes to put settlements in. It's also a crime because the occupier has a duty to protect the people in the occupied lands and not to displace them and not to put their own people in those lands. Also, just, you know, attacking civilians in any situation is illegal. And also property destruction without military necessity is also illegal. So that's another way in which they're war crimes. What Caterpillar could have done, a number of things. They could have, first of all, requested that the IDF not use their products for illegal, unlawful purposes. And if they weren't going to do that, they could have stopped selling to them. And they also, Caterpillar, the exact facts are unclear because they're very secretive about what's actually been done. But, you know, they claim even on their website that they modify the bulldozers for military use, or that they can do that, and that they create, manufacture, and design armor kits to make the bulldozers better used in war zones or areas like that. So there were a lot of things that they did do actively after they had noticed that they should have stopped doing.
So these bulldozers, in fact, are different from the ones used domestically in the States for farming and...
Well, first of all, we have to realize that these bulldozers, the D9s and the D10s, which are specifically used in Palestine and in areas like this, are enormous. They're maybe 60, 70, 80 tons. They're not what you see on the corner of your street. They are armored specifically for use. Whether or not they are armored in Israel by a different company, or whether or not Caterpillar is just making it easier for them to be somehow designing them or modifying the design to make them more easily armored, is not really a question. But yeah, they're different than the ones we see.
What is the lawsuit asking for, aside from stopping this?
Really, what the Corys want is the truth. You know, they've been trying to figure out what really happened to their daughter and get answers and accountability for that for the past 2 years, and they have not been able to, neither from the U.S. government, neither Caterpillar wouldn't respond to them.
So they want information. They want the truth. They want the facts.
They want
disclosed.
The truth, and they want to hold Caterpillar accountable. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they are asking for compensatory and punitive damages, not that anything could compensate them for their tragic loss.
The plaintiffs in the case are Rachel's parents?
Yes.
Now, are there also going to be other people added to the case, Palestinians?
Yeah, we're talking right now to Palestinians who are very interested in joining the case, and we would like to do that. There have been many, many Palestinians who have also been killed or injured in these demolitions, besides the 50,000 or so more that have become homeless.
You know, we'd hear about people being crushed to death in their home as it collapsed on top of them, and that was not at all uncommon.
Right. They're rarely given notice. Many times you hear stories of people pleading. There was one man who was in a wheelchair. His family, his mother, and his sisters were pleading with the bulldozers to just give them enough time to get him out, and they didn't, and he was crushed and killed.
I read the complaint after it was filed, and it's really a devastating story about the way the bulldozers are used. And one thing I think I'd encourage people to do is, I think you can go to the CCR website and read the complaint, because it really gives the story, not just of Rachel's death, but of the way these caterpillars have been used, you know, for many years now, to really just demolish and kill Palestinians. It's at ccr-ny.org, ccr-ny.org. What's the next step in the case?
Well, we'll be, as you said, we'll try to add Palestinian plaintiffs soon, and then there is expected a motion to dismiss by Caterpillar, and we'll be dealing with that.
So what about the soldier who was operating the bulldozer?
You know, there was... a limited investigation that I'm not even sure was completed by Israel, which said, either found or said that he at least claimed that he could not see Rachel. You know, there was 8 other International Solidarity Movement members in the area. Everyone, you know, is certain that could not have been the truth. There is now a case also in Israel that the Corys have brought against the IDF and Israel and the Ministry of Defense. There's also...
Who's handling that one?
Hussein Abu Hussein, an attorney in Israel. There's, I think, going to be a move to get the investigation completed or finished.
Yeah, one of the things that seemed suspect to me as soon as I saw those photographs was the fact that after Rachel was crushed and lying on the ground and her friends were rushed around her, cradling her broken body, there was no sign of a soldier. There were soldiers around, and yet no one approached her to help, to aid, nothing. And that alone seemed like an indictment, a pretty strong one, of their guilt.
Right. No one did anything. They had to, the volunteers had to go back into the house that was going to be demolished to call an ambulance to come after her.
Has there been any negative response to your filing of the case?
Yes, unfortunately, of course. There's been a lot of negative emails that CCR has received.
What kind of stuff do they say?
Some of it is really too disgusting to even repeat. I think people don't have an understanding of what's actually happening in Palestine, and don't understand and think that things that happen far away, corporations in the U.S. shouldn't be held liable for. But fortunately, that's not the case. They can be held liable, and they should.
Is there precedent for that?
There's several courts that have said that, yes, corporations in the United States who have been complicit with human rights violations abroad can be held liable.
Tell us about some of those cases. Are there good examples?
There are several cases against oil companies for either through their exploration and production in other countries like Nigeria or Burma have either aided and abetted the military in stopping protesting by killing people or torturing people. Another case which was brought against UNICAL for actions in Burma where the military was clearing land for the laying of a pipeline when people were tortured and enslaved to work on the pipeline. That case was recently settled.
We did bring one case a number of years ago at the center against a company that manufactured tear gas. It was in Pennsylvania. And we eventually settled that case, and the tear gas was being sold to the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, and was either too powerful of tear gas or was being misused in Palestinian homes, in Jerusalem in particular. And people were dying and women were aborting. Right. And that was one of the cases that is similar to this of a product that was used and misused by the IDF.
Right. And that case also settled.
And that case settled as well.
So the State of Israel recently announced that they are going to halt house demolitions.
Well, they haven't claimed that they're going to halt all house demolitions, just those that are in retaliation for act by a family member, such as a bombing or an attack. So they don't claim to halt them for anything, any other purpose.
So the ones for land grab will still be going on.
Right. And the ones that are in retaliation are really only a small, maybe 5% of the actual home demolitions that are done.
Hey, Maria LaHood from the Center for Constitutional Rights on the suit by Rachel Corrie's family members. Thank you.
Good luck with the case.
Thank you, Maria.
Thanks.
On August 13, 2004, two U.S. citizens, Zain Afzal and Kashan Afzal, both U.S. citizens of Pakistani origin, disappeared from their home in Karachi. They were abducted, and it's unclear whether they're being held by Pakistani authorities or at the behest of American authorities. Nobody's heard from them since that night in August. With us on the phone, we have Brad Adams, the Executive Director of the Asia Division of Human Rights Watch. Brad, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks.
Brad put out a great report through Human Rights Watch in early March. And Brad, why don't you describe for us a little bit about what you found out about these two Pakistani Americans?
Sure. They had moved back to Karachi. They have family living in Chicago in the U.S. They had trained, as far as we know, in Punjab with some Islamic groups, probably to thinking about possibly going to fight in Kashmir over the Indian occupation there. But to our knowledge, they committed no criminal acts. They've never been arrested. And there's an allegation at this point that they ever went to Afghanistan or were involved with Al-Qaeda or any other groups there. And they were at home, and in the middle of the night, about 20 cars, jeeps, that fit the description of what the Pakistani security forces normally use, showed up at their house. They knocked down an exterior wall. They knocked down the door to their house. They came into the house. They took the two men. They held them. They questioned them. They separated them from their mother who was there and the wife of one of them who was there. They ended up locking the mother in a room, thinking that they had disconnected all telephones. I don't know what they expected was going to happen to her, but it turned out that she had a cell phone and was able to call relatives and the police, who let her out a couple of hours later. They took these people, these two men, away. This was witnessed by many neighbors who were ordered at gunpoint back into their homes, and they haven't been seen since.
Do we have any idea where they might be? Do we have any idea whether the U.S. was involved at all?
Well, there are witnesses who say that there were American-accented voices speaking on intercom radios to people who were in the house and who were outside. This is the kind of report that one has to take with some care, because this is the kind of allegation that often is made and is hard to substantiate. But what made us particularly concerned about U.S. government involvement was that the FBI, in Chicago, showed up at the house of the sister of the brothers. She's also an American citizen.
In Chicago?
In Chicago. Began to interrogate the sister about their brothers, and in the process made it clear that they knew many things about the brothers that the FBI could only know if they were either part of the operation or had been briefed by the Pakistanis. Now, one further thing that has happened since we put out a report makes us actually more concerned that they might be in U.S. custody or that the U.S. has known all along from the arrest about them, which is that the U.S. government, two different parts of the U.S. government, have told us they cannot give us any more information about these two brothers because of U.S. Privacy Act considerations. And if one considers possible grounds for invoking that, it's hard to think of any that wouldn't involve the U.S. knowing plenty about what was going on and possibly having them in their custody.
Brad, I don't get the Privacy Act invocation. Could the wife make a similar request and see if that could get good help?
Well, exactly. The Privacy Act would be intended to protect them.
Right.
Brad, explain how the Privacy Act is used.
Well, to be honest with you, I only know about it in the war on terror context. They say that the Privacy Act is meant to shield individuals from unwanted public attention and that information held in government custody should not be made public without their permission.
Well, I mean, we've heard that used over and over again from, you know, the day after September 11th.
Yeah.
We're rounding up Arab and Muslim men off the streets and keeping them in detention and not letting their families know or not letting them have access to attorneys, not letting the press know who's there to protect them.
Virtually anybody who has had family members particularly trying to find out about them would not want the Privacy Act invoked. Clearly, they'd want to have their family members know where they are, and they'd want to have access to counsel.
Could be a classic sort of rendition case, or it could just be the Pakistanis holding them. We just don't know. Is that the point?
We don't know. I mean, I think that the most likely scenario is that they're being held by the Pakistanis for their intelligence value for the U.S., and that the U.S. has known about it all along. But, you know, that's really outrageous, because Pakistan has a long history of using torture. It's well documented by us and others. Usually what happens in Pakistan is people are disappeared, but it's, I guess, slightly more gentlemanly than in other countries, because they tend to let family members know. And they say, look, you know, we're holding them and we'll let you know. But, you know, one way or another, they're informed, usually informally, that people are being held and that family members shouldn't worry. Now, it could be that something bad has happened to them, and that's why they want to disclaim knowledge.
Wow.
It would not be terribly unusual for people to die in custody from mistreatment in Pakistan. And that's what we're most worried about. Obviously, that's what the family's most worried about.
How often does this sort of thing happen?
Disappearances.
Well, it's been a perennial problem since the military's either been in power or essentially been in power as the behind the curtain of a civilian government. You remember when Bush said, either you're with us or you're against us after September 11th, that was aimed at Pakistan more than any country in the world. Musharraf, you know, dithered for a couple of days, but then he came down firmly on the U.S. side.
Brad Adams of Human Rights Watch, thank you. You can go to www.hrw.org for more information.
Thank you, Brad.
Okay.
Okay, bye-bye. On March 11th, we had another report given to Congress about the torture scandal, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, and Afghanistan. This time, it was Vice Admiral Church, Navy Inspector General, who supposedly interviewed 800 people, was going to make a completely thorough report and really bring this matter, apparently, to where the government wants it, which is nowhere. The report was the usual. We got what we expected. A complete whitewash. It's the 10th report that the government has done already. So far, they all look down the chain of command and not up the chain of command. They all look down at the lower-level soldiers and blame them. And the usual conclusions, euphemisms, and bull came out of the report. So, for example, the report concludes, there's no link between approved interrogation techniques and detainee abuse. Yet we know that in approved interrogation techniques included the use of dogs, chaining to the floor, sleep deprivation, beatings, sexual tactics, religious tactics, and others. And yet somehow, there's no link between those interrogation techniques and detainee abuse. We're going to discuss that report today with both Dahlia and Heidi. Dahlia, any thoughts about this?
I was totally disgusted. I think those of us who have read the Inspector General's reports from the Department of Justice, you know, Inspector Glenn Fine, were somewhat hopeful that there might be some kind of integrity. But really, all this proved was that we need an independent investigator.
Right. What Dahlia is referring to is the reports that Inspector Fine made about internal detentions in the United States of Muslims after 9/11, which were quite hard-hitting. But so far, of course, we've gotten nothing. And you have to remember, look who's in charge of this thing. First, in the military side, you got Rumsfeld at the top. So it's not like they're going to look up to Rumsfeld. They're going to look down. On the civil side, you got Gonzalez, one of the famous authors of the torture memo, attorney general. So you really got now a conspiracy to cover up torture after the conspiracy to commit torture.
Yeah, and Church had limited authority to actually look at his supervisors or anyone who is higher ranked than he is. So what do you have him doing? You have him making a decision that the abuse is not the result of any policy decisions, and yet he's unable to look at the decision makers. What kind of sense does that make?
Dahlia and Michael, are there going to be hearings on this report? Is it available for the public to read?
One of the things about the report, we're only getting the 20-page summary of the report, which you can get online.
Right.
The full report, which is classified, we can't read. One guy who's falling as a result of this report, though, is the Defense Department General Counsel William Haynes. I think he's up for a nomination, is that right, for a court now? And it appears that he was quite involved in setting the interrogation techniques and was one of the people who refused or didn't allow the military people to actually discuss and have great input or really dictate what should be the interrogation techniques. In fact, it was done out of the other guys, you know, the Cheneys of the world, the Rumsfelds of the world. And it looks like Haynes may take a fall on this one.
The people who I think really need to be held responsible aren't going to be held responsible as a result of this. This is a farce, and I think we might just need to throw it out and keep insisting that an independent investigator look at this and really decide what's going on. But we're not getting a lot of help from either side of the table. You know, you have Democrats like Lieberman from Connecticut saying, oh, the conclusions that this guy came to, well, that's correct. And, you know, he said 70 cases out of 50,000 detainees is about 0.1%. The report looked at 70 cases. But that's not the extent of the abuse. If you want to be real about this, if you want to look at what's truly happening, you look at the documents that are being revealed. You can get it on the ACLU website, www.aclu.org. Download them. Look at what they say. These abuses are not the result of 70 cases. These abuses are the result of clear and widespread policy decisions.
Think about it. You have authorizations from the top because of all those memos. You have Gonzalez's memo, the Bybee memo, redefining torture. Say the president can use torture. Then you have a series of papers saying you can use dogs, a whole bunch of techniques that you can use. And then you have what actually happened. So you have step one, step two, and step three. And what do you get at the end? But torture. And what do you get at the end right now in the Bush administration is an utter and complete whitewash. Luckily, at least, there's some action being taken. ACLU and Human Rights First has a lawsuit against Rumsfeld for damages. The center has a similar lawsuit against Rumsfeld for damages for the Guantanamo people. There's a lawsuit that the center has against Titan Khaki, the private interrogators.
And wait another 3 years and we'll see what pops up about Bush. You know, he can't be sued while he's immune. You know, he has immunity right. While he's president. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But I think that guy is in 3 years. He's going to be hoping that there was some chance that he could be in there for another four because he's got something coming.
I mean, this scandal goes, that's the right word, goes all the way to the top. And it's just a matter of time until we get these guys. The ones that are older now may not be around in 3 or 4 or 5 years due to natural causes, but the younger ones who authorize this, they're going to be behind the bars.
But they're going to try to pin it on people, the low-level people if they can. They don't care about them. They don't care about the people who carry this out. They just want to cover their butts.
They have a joke down in Fort Hood, Texas, where they're trying some of the lower level people. What they say is these people are being tried in Fort Hood. They're lower level people. And they say the military say we're hoodwinking the public.
And isn't that the truth?
That's right.
Explain why you've approved of and expanded the practice of what's called rendition, of transferring individuals out of U.S. custody to countries where human rights groups and your own State Department say torture is common for people in custody.
Post 9/11 world, the United States must make sure we protect our people and our friends from attack. That was the charge we had been given. And one way to do so is to arrest people and send them back to their country of origin with the promise that they won't be tortured. That's the promise we receive. This country does not believe in torture. We do believe in protecting ourselves. We don't believe in torture.
The Pentagon plans to move around half of its 540 remaining prisoners from Guantanamo Bay back to home countries like Saudi Arabia, Afghanistan, Yemen, and Egypt, where the fear is, like so many other rendition victims, they'll be subject to increased torture. We have with us Barbara Olshansky, a lead attorney with the Center for Constitutional Rights, who's been at the forefront of the fight to challenge the Bush administration's position on enemy combatants. Barbara, I know you're exhausted and haven't slept much, so we're especially grateful to have you here with us at Law and Disorder. Welcome.
Thank you for having me today.
So what's going on with the Pentagon's plans?
Well, it's actually very difficult to say. The report came out of the New York Times and Reuters. It was fairly specific about hundreds of people being moved. It came out a week ago Friday, and immediately counsel for all of the different petitioners, detainees in our Guantanamo cases got very worried because we don't get advance notice of when people are being moved.
I mean, this is a little strange, isn't it? Because just in December of this past year, it was announced that they were seeking something like $200 million, or I don't remember the exact number, but some extraordinary amount of money, so they could actually build a permanent detention facility on Guantanamo Bay. So the idea was that they're going to make this a permanent place for these folks, hold them indefinitely, and now it looks like they're actually hurrying to move people out.
Well, you know, it's very difficult for us to know what's going on. You're right. Brown & Root, the subsidiary of Halliburton, did get a huge contract to build and are, in fact, building a permanent facility down there. That's been confirmed. Whether or not that facility is intended for the people that are currently in Guantanamo, we're not sure. And the government has been, you know, back and forth, you know, waffling back and forth about what they're going to do. We had assumed, like most people had, that people that were called an enemy combatant, that stayed an enemy combatant after they went through these ridiculous tribunals, and that were considered, you know, not to be eligible for leaving the island, were going to go into those prisons. And in fact, they had also said that people that had gone through the military commission, that separate trial process, might be imprisoned on the island. But as most people know, I think, the judge found that commission process to be wholly unconstitutional and violating international law, and the process has just been on hold while that case wends its way up the court. So we don't know actually how the permanent facility relates to the people in Guantanamo. And our immediate concern was, where are you sending people?
Yeah, and what are you afraid is going to happen?
This has been a problem since the very beginning. We don't get notice of when people are being released. And people are released to their country of origin. That's what the Army tells us.
Not their country of citizenship.
No, nor their country of most recent residency. And for many, you know, people have left their country of origin seeking political asylum and being granted political asylum in other countries. We get notice that after somebody's already been sent back somewhere, it's too late. We haven't been able to keep track of what happens to people in a lot of those countries because there are not very many human rights groups permitted on the ground in those countries.
So they just kind of disappear.
They disappear.
You know, it seems like there are international laws as well as laws here in the United States that ought to prevent this type of thing.
Well, in fact, there are. I mean, and this is where the battle is really coming to a head right now. Because with this announcement, what we said is, you can't do this. The Convention Against Torture prohibits it. It's been signed and ratified by the United States. People are allowed to make a showing that they're personally afraid, and then we cannot send them there. And the government's position is, well, they don't get a lawyer in that process, and we don't think judges belong in that process.
But how would people even make a showing? I mean, these are folks who aren't even allowed to see, you know, their attorneys. They're not allowed access to the courts. How would anyone hope that they could make any type of showing?
Well, what we've done is there are a great many people now that do have lawyers. And the remaining people, which is quite a number, about 500, we think, who don't have lawyers, we filed at the Center for Constitutional Rights this lawsuit in the name of John Doe's 1 through 570. And we said, these people need to be able to have a lawyer. You can't preclude them from having a lawyer. The Supreme Court said they get a lawyer. We want to give them a lawyer. Now we're battling in that case to try and get lawyers for everybody else, just to have their day in
court. They're doing everything they can to stop people from getting lawyers. And actually, there was a great article recently that described how some of the interrogators at Guantanamo Bay were trying to grow a mistrust within the detainees of their lawyers. So they were saying things like, don't you know you shouldn't trust your lawyer? Your lawyer is Jewish. And one of the detainees apparently had a great retort. He just looked right back at the interrogator and said, there are people of every faith who believe in justice.
You know, that was a great day for us to hear that we had actually succeeded. You know, we, like this whole group of people, had succeeded in building that trust in people down there because it was something we were concerned about. You know, we are Americans, like the soldiers that are down there. And we are very concerned about getting proper translators for the dialects and building that faith in us.
Yeah, and after 3 years in that kind of intense custody where there is torture going on and there's all kinds of misrepresentation and lies being told.
Yeah, I actually was just reading an article by a group of doctors about what torture does, even if it's not physical torture, does to people. And that, I think, it's just been horrifying to me to see the level of sophistication in torture that can cause personality breakdown. And that's something we've just been worried about the whole time, and part of the reason we've been trying to get doctors down there, which has just been absolutely barred by the government.
The torture at Guantanamo, I mean, that we're seeing coming in the documents and what's been confirmed by government sources is truly a disaster. It's horrible. And I wonder how much worse is it going to be for folks? Is it going to be all that much worse? I mean, right now, you have folks who the United States are trying to keep in a legal black hole who are being tortured, held away from the world. What is the difference between holding them there and transferring them to another country?
Well, you know, that's a very interesting question. I think my insight comes from another case that I'm working on for the center, which is Maher Arar versus John Ashcroft. And Mr. Arar is a Syrian-Canadian. He's a Canadian citizen who was born in Syria and was sent by the United States. He was picked up in JFK while he was transferring flights on his way home from Switzerland to Ottawa. He was picked up and held in the United States and then sent to Syria.
And he's a citizen of Canada.
He's a citizen of Canada. He left Syria when he was 16. And he left in order to avoid service in the army there. He left because his family didn't agree with the regime. And he was greatly concerned about being sent to Syria. He hadn't been there in over, 18 years.
Yeah. So getting sent back to Syria, having avoided compulsory military duty, is truly disastrous. That's a promise of torture.
It is. It really is. And what he suffered when he was tortured for 10 and a half months there is, it's hard to compare torture. It's so awful that it's really hard to even read the words on the page more than once.
What happened to him?
He lived in what they call a cave, a concrete bunker, 6 feet by 7 feet by 3 feet, buried underneath the ground. Rats biting him, very little food, very little water, beaten mercilessly with cables, threatened with something they called a German chair, which they put you on in an effort to break your spine slowly.
Are these the types of things that Guantanamo detainees, if transferred, might experience?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's our really great concern. I mean, there are horrible tortures in Tajikistan. Our Department of State country reports, right here in the United States, our own Department of State, documents the human rights violations of other countries. And if you look, for the last 10 years, the country reports for Syria are horrible. And they actually name all of these different devices. They name the German chair. They name all of these prisons and specifically what happened. So we know, and we know that in Tajikistan, where people could be returned, they boil people alive.
Wow. So let me ask you, why take people who they have said they want to question and they want to interrogate? Why take them out of their custody and put them in another country's custody?
I think there's probably two things going on. I think that they have not, and actually the officers down in Guantanamo have confirmed this, they have not gotten the information they thought they would get from people. I think there are many people that realize that's because these are not the right folks.
Yeah, there's no information. I mean, they've admitted there's no information to be had from these folks, and what they've gotten, that's it. Nothing else is coming.
And so I think part of it is, well, what are we going to do now? We have to send these people somewhere.
Is this saving face?
Maybe. Maybe some of it is still the hope or belief that some of these people have information. And
the hope or the faith that some of these people have information? How are you going to get that type of information from someone who's being severely tortured in another country?
Well, you've hit on the exact contradiction of this entire policy. Because if you talk to anyone that is really a member of the armed forces, and there are a great many generals and admirals that have been on our side in this case, from the time we brought Rasul to the Supreme Court, who have said, this is not the way we do this. We don't do this anything like this. And who have confirmed that statements taken under torture are incredibly unreliable. People will say anything. They'll sit there and say, I'm not a man, I'm really a woman under torture. And yet this is a practice that is still ongoing, even knowing. And now we even have had proof that these statements are unreliable, and still the Department of Defense continues with this policy.
So it just seems to me that Guantanamo for the administration has been a public relations disaster on a couple of fronts. First of all, they're losing the legal battle. They came out really boldly and said, listen, this is a legal black hole. We have the right to do whatever we want with these folks, and they have no legal rights whatsoever. And they're losing in the courts.
Right.
Through the cases that you have pushed, their case has fallen apart. And the second thing that we're seeing is the torture and the conditions, the heinous conditions that are going on inside of Guantanamo in these so-called interrogations. All of this is slowly making its way out into the press, and public opinion is really turning. Do you think that has anything to do with them trying to move people out of Guantanamo?
I think so. I hope so. I mean, I think it has taken a long time for this information to make it into the public arena, to make it to the press, because of how closed the island was, of how secretive everything was. And once you know, the leaking started, you know, once the memos came out where you saw discussions at the highest level about what level of excruciating pain constitutes torture, I think people started being horrified that this was being done in their name by their country. This is not the country that we all think of. I do hope that people are seeing and are horrified at it, and that has an effect. But, you know, at some level, I stay very worried that this administration doesn't feel that it has to listen to anybody. And on the bottom rung of who it doesn't have to listen to are the people of this country. Because the Supreme Court was really clear in Rasool and in the Hamdi case that, you know, it said you don't have a blank check to do whatever you want. Justice O'Connor said that. She's not, you know, this radical liberal justice. She's very clear, very pragmatic, very judicious and conservative. And they, you know, 6-3 was the vote in Rasool that said these people have these rights. And yet we have an administration that has put up every roadblock to people getting the benefit of the right the Supreme Court says they have. It's just this flagrant unwillingness and denial to comply with the Supreme Court's rule. And I don't think I've ever seen it in the history of the Supreme Court in this country.
Barbara Olshansky from the Center for Constitutional Rights, thanks for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Twenty-three-year-old American citizen Ahmed Omar Abu Ali left the United States to go study abroad in Saudi Arabia. At the end of the academic year in 2003, he was due to return home, but he never did. Turned out he was picked up, put in a Saudi prison, held and tortured for 20 months. He's finally back in the U.S., but now he's been charged with having associated with alleged terrorists. On the phone to discuss this case is Mort Sklar, with the World Organization for Human Rights, USA. Mort, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be here.
Mort, you know, it's really great to have you. I want to tell people, Mort won an extraordinary case on behalf of Abu Ali. He filed a writ of habeas corpus, even though Abu Ali was technically in Saudi custody, not in U.S. custody, according to at least the Saudis. Mort, why don't you tell us a little bit about how that happened? It's just an extraordinary victory, really.
Well, it's worth also explaining what happened, how the case came to us. The sister of Ahmed Abu Ali came to us and was really desperate for assistance. Ahmed had been held at that point, I think it was for 16 months in Saudi Arabia. But the key point was that it wasn't just something that the Saudi Arabian government was doing. This was something that the U.S. government had asked Saudi Arabia to do and had continued to ask them to keep him in custody during that whole period of time, and to interrogate him as a suspected terrorist. And so the issue was whether U.S. courts could exercise jurisdiction over somebody, a U.S. citizen, to be sure, but somebody who was being held by a foreign government. And the government said, no, you can't do this. The habeas corpus case can't be filed against somebody being held outside of the U.S. by a foreign government. We challenged that. We won. We got a super opinion from a very conservative Bush-appointed judge by the name of John Bates, who held that the U.S. courts could, in fact, review this so long as there was some showing that the U.S. government was involved.
That's what I found extraordinary. I mean, both parts of it. One, that you got that victory. But secondly, what was the evidence you had that the U.S. was involved? How did you get that?
There was lots of evidence to that effect. First of all, at the same time that he was arrested in Saudi Arabia, the FBI raided his house in Virginia, where he lived with his family. There was no way they could have gotten a search warrant unless they knew ahead of time that he was going to be arrested in Saudi Arabia.
this is a little bit different than the rendition cases that we've been accustomed to talking about. This isn't someone who was in U.S. custody and transferred to out of the United States into another country. This is someone who freely decided to go study abroad, and the United States took advantage of his decision to go study abroad.
Absolutely. It is a variant of rendition, but we consider it to be a rendition case. I'll tell you why. It seems to us that it's the same concept of, even though he was already there, it was the U.S. government saying, we can't do these things to this guy, particularly because he's a citizen. We can't detain him. We can't interrogate him this way, using torture.
What kind of torture was he subject
to? Sure, we haven't had a chance to talk to him about what kinds of torture were involved, but clearly there was some kind of intimidation and torture taking place during that period. He talked about it with his parents by telephone.
So after you won this case, I think you were on the verge of really getting some discovery or filing, you know, trying to find out more. And all of a sudden, the United States or the government seems to get an indictment here in the United States. Is that right?
That's what happened. Under the pressure of having either to tell the court what exactly had happened in this case and probably come out with a lot of stuff showing that the U.S. government had requested the detention and had requested the interrogation, and told Saudi Arabia, do not send him back. In order to prevent that from coming out, the U.S. government really had no choice but to bring him back to the U.S. That's what they did. But there have been a lot of news stories about the fact that they did not want to be in a position where they had to let him go free, and so they concocted the story about all his involvements with reading material about the jihad and other things that connected him in some way to potential terrorism. And so he is under indictment now and is being held on criminal charges in Virginia.
The only article I read the other day talked about material aiding terrorism, but said the key witness against him was dead.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, what he's actually charged with is having associated with terrorists, not having conspired, but having associated. And part of what's being used is from the raid on his parents' home is reading materials, and I believe a gun, which Virginia residents doesn't sound that unusual.
The gun was in Saudi Arabia, I believe, but yes, that's right. There's nothing involved in the case that they've shown so far that would be very different from anybody else in his situation having done. There's no action. It's just reading and talking with people.
Another reason that this case is so important to take note of is because the new intelligence bill that Congress passed last year has in it a provision that really turns on its head a strong premise of the American legal system that says, listen, the government has the burden of proof always in a criminal case. The accused does not have to prove his innocence. And in this case, Abu Ali is being forced to prove that to get out on bail, he is not a danger to his community. It's not the other way around. Typically, the government would have to prove that he's a danger. Now he's having to prove that he's not.
The government is in such a strong position as far as these terrorism charges. They have such leeway, and it shows so much in this case where here the government was on the ropes with respect to this habeas petition. And just by bringing him home and filing charges against him, everybody's attention, the media's attention, was focused not on what the bad things that the government, U.S. government, had been doing, but on the charges that had been made. And so the focus shifted so radically.
Kind of a Padilla in reverse.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, but they even brought the President of the United States in somehow, as I recall.
Right.
Yeah. And I mean, in his State of the Union address, it's, you know, President Bush was trying to refute these charges that they do, you know, that we torture. He said torture is never acceptable, nor do we hand people over to countries that do torture. But increasingly, the evidence is pointing otherwise, and this is one of those cases. Mort Sklar from the World Organization for Human Rights USA, thank you for joining us on Law and Disorder.
Pleasure to be with you.
Thanks, Morton. Congratulations again. It was a great victory.
Thanks for your interest, and I'm glad we're all working on this.
Great.
Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady. Thank you all for tuning in today, and a special thanks to several of our guests, Barbara Olshansky, Brad Adams, Maria LaHood, and Mort Sklar. Be sure to listen in for our next show on April 4th.
The ideas expressed here on Law & Disorder are our own and not those of the organizations for which we work.
Say love, oh love, oh love, oh love. I had a love so pure, so strong. Take me straight to my